To do that, we have been working in the mentoring program and also in Avid. We added a mentoring program this year, and we are focusing on African-American males, and it is in a partnership with the St. Paul Public School Foundation, and it's working, and we're hopefully we are going to be able to reach 80 students in 39,000 kids. It doesn't seem a lot, but what we've been able to do is we took students in eighth grade and we're continuing them to ninth grade, and we're going to follow the path with the mentoring. And we already are seeing how the students are improving the grades, coming to school, and discipline has improved. Avid has been in a program. This is our ninth year of Avid. And for you, I imagine you're very aware what Avid is, but it has taking out our students who are in the bubble, mm-hmm. those kids who can go towards non-graduating or towards graduating, and giving them the skills. And we have an 88 participation graduation. And then from those students, we have a great number of those students going to college. And it's amazing when you compare with the peers, because we provide them the support and the strengths and the skills. And we have more access, as the commissioner said, to college credit courses. And also we have up our ACT participation in our district. Then the tutoring, it's go ahead. We have had almost 2,000 parents going through the Parent Academy, and it's meeting our 72% of our graduation goal. And this, we are expecting to graduate another 1,000 in the next few months. We have a parent advisory council in our district who has help us. We have a parent advisory council, but also for different cultures and languages, as you can see, bilingual, African American and American Indian. We also have our special education advisory council has given us a lot of tips and ways to get back into how we can do business better. And also we have some school-based PTOs or PACs, as we call it in St. Paul. We have, and then the mayor is going to take, we have worked very in collaboration and structuring the way we do the after-school program through the Sprocket network, and St. Paul and the city are just really working together on that. We also have been participating in Promise Neighborhood, which involves the Ward 1, and it's for us is Maxfield and Jackson, and we also are working with the mayor on our new initiative, which is called Right Track, in which is a youth employment, and it's internship for students. And I tell you, I have not seen so much growth in kids in 6 to 8 weeks who came to the internship and starting, and how they finish at the end of the summer. It's truly, truly an eye-opening to the real world for them. So with that, I'll pass it to the mayor, and I'll do the slide, mayor, if I know how to do it.
I did it so well for her, so.
Great team.
It's hard to do PowerPoint for someone else's presentation. Thank you,
welcome,
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about the approach that we've taken in the city of St. Paul in collaboration with not only the school district but all community-based partners to figure out how we're going to not only close the achievement gap but do it very quickly, accelerate the pace of change that we have seen over the last several years, and make sure that we don't leave another generation of children in the city of St. Paul behind. I think what we're doing is not only a model for the state, but I think it's a model for the country. And it begins with what the superintendent has just outlined in terms of what is happening within the district. When she outlined Strong School Strong Community program several years ago, it was a real effort to reevaluate the programs that were employed, eliminate the ones that weren't working, change how we're delivering services to the children, and do it in a very targeted way. We saw gains under that initial program, and just with 2 weeks ago launched Strong School Strong Communities 2.0 to really take this to the next level. But from the city of St. Paul standpoint, we said that there was an incredible need for the schools to rearrange how they were doing their work, and obviously the primary focus is going to be on the classroom, what's happening in the school buildings. But that when a child only spends 20% of their time inside the classroom and 80% of their time outside the school building, clearly there was a community role and a need for the community to step in and figure out how it could align its resources to support what was happening in the district. I think either way, if you are making great strides in the schools but not doing the community-based support, you're going to fail. If you're doing the community-based support but the schools aren't changing, you're going to fail. And so we've worked very hard to create programs like the Sprockets program, which is our out-of-school time network. We're working what I consider a narrow bandwidth but citywide. And then we also have the Promise Neighborhood, which is a deep dive but in a narrow geographic area in the Frogtown and Summit University neighborhoods. We've also recently launched and expanded our Right Track Youth Summer Employment Program. That's really a kind of a three-step process for youth to get an initial job, perhaps with the park system during the course of a year. The next year would be a business owner that would employ a youth for the summer. And then ultimately, through Genesis Works and other partnerships, that youth would have an opportunity to have real high-tech training and develop a really specific skill set. And so we think that that is a really helpful piece to what we're doing. But I have, as difficult as it is for someone who doesn't control the school system, I have made it very clear that I wish to be measured by how successful we are in closing the achievement gap over the next 4 years, as well as the preceding 8 years that I've been in office. In 2006, I formed the Citizen Commission called the Second Shift Commission to work on a citywide out-of-school time network. And in 2011, Superintendent Silva and I launched that fully formed network, now called Sprockets, as I mentioned. Sprockets works with community nonprofits to improve their after-school programs, ultimately helping them be meaningful in terms of how they interact with children and the kind of lessons that can be imparted. It helps parents and youth find after-school and summer programs based on their age, interests, and where they live.
We already did. Yeah, okay. Sorry.
It's hard to do. About 40% of our Sprockets organizations provide academic support as well as other enrichment activities, including college readiness skills. We also created a data system to help youth programs share data and see how their youth participants were doing academically. Obviously, data sharing and kind of left and right hands knowing how a child is doing is critically important, and so developing these systems is a key part of our work. But the Sprockets program works very closely with the St. Paul Public School System. And this year we helped the district create two additional after-school hubs where elementary children receive over 3 hours of academics and enrichment, meals, and transportation home. The Wallace Foundation has been a key partner in this. They have stated that Sprockets is one of the leading programs in the country for helping youth programs use data to improve their practice and serve the learning needs of youth better. Next slide. Promise Neighborhood. Promise Neighborhood Initiative is another one that has been key. We've seen a similar and quite frankly, even more developed program in the Northside Achievement Zone. This is all modeled after what Jeffrey Canada was doing in the Harlem Children's Zone, and we've learned a lot from both the Northside Achievement Zone and Jeffrey Canada's work, but also the work that we've done over the last several years. In 2010, we brought the community together. We brought Ramsey County together with the Wilder Foundation to apply for the federal grant, planning grant. We were successful at getting the planning grant and did a lot of work. We haven't been able to achieve the ultimate goal, which is to get the full funding from the federal government, but that has not stopped us in our work. We have really focused on children on ages birth to five. We've worked with families in a 250-block area of the Frogtown and Summit University neighborhoods to really assess their needs and help them achieve have access to the services that they need. There are three schools that are the primary focus of the Promise Neighborhood: Jackson, Maxfield, and the city's St. Paul City School, which is a charter school. All three of those are key partners in this initiative. We focus in on early learning scholarships that have been very helpful. We are looking at academic improvement, including a six-week Freedom School during the course of the summer. We've expanded that participation in the Freedom School. It is a remarkable program that I would encourage anyone who hasn't had a chance to go in and see what happens during the course of a day. They start the morning getting the kids all fired up and ready to learn and excited about it, and it has proven results. We also know that parent engagement is a critical piece of this, and we're working on that. It's one of the reasons why I stepped forward to help support The work of the parent academies that the schools are doing to expand participation in that. Parents have to have an idea how they can support their children's learning, how they can access the schools. And I've talked to teachers who have said that you can identify a parent very easily who's gone through the parent academy just in the confidence that they have when they walk in to address their children's academic needs. We think that the high-quality after-school programs is a critical component that children have to have access to. There's reams of data on how important those programs are. We know that the health and social services aspect of this is critically important, which is why we have Health Partners has been a healthcare provider in the Promise Neighborhood Initiative. That's been very helpful. Ultimately, stable housing contributes to the well-being and the academic success of the children. So we've had $750,000 for rent credits and other funding to help stabilize housing. And we've just brought in as much community support as we could whenever possible. Just briefly on the right track, I've kind of outlined that earlier. We just think that a child who has access to a first work experience is going to, first of all, know what that looks like, know how to get into it, know what the expectations are, and really help them. We're really focused in on a whole child, whole being model, which is, it's not just about getting them academically, through the school year, but really preparing them to be successful in life. During our summer youth program, we had about 500 youth that were employed. This was money that was funded by DEED and federal CDBG grant dollars and has been, I think, a very successful program that we've launched together with the Chamber of Commerce and the superintendent to try to expand those opportunities for children. They're a very successful model in the Step Up Summer Jobs program in Minneapolis. That's been a great program. We think that the distinction in our work in the city of St. Paul is really creating that kind of three-step process that ultimately leads to a job where a child is working in a more corporate setting, a more professional setting than the first job that they would have had in the Parks and Rec system. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit because I want to talk a little bit about example of the work that we're doing together. This may be slightly off context, but our EMS Academy, Emergency Medical Services Academy, has provided an incredible opportunity for children that have the abilities but had no kind of path forward into the medical services field. So we actually have formed a partnership where children or young adults, rather, many of whom have children of their own. They've graduated from high school but don't have a lot of other educational background. And don't really have a path forward necessarily. We get them in. They're actually paid to go through the EMS Academy. It allows them to not only get a job, with a private ambulance service, but obviously gives them a leg up as they're trying to get into a fire department, particularly in the city of St. Paul. It's just an example of creating opportunities and paths forward for our young adults to be successful. There's a lot. The problem when I get going on this, there's a lot that we can talk about, as the superintendent kind of alluded to, just so much that's happening in the St. Paul school system. She mentioned the racial equity work. That was something that we have worked with the St. Paul public school system and Ramsey County and the city of St. Paul to really focus in on what are the systems and practices that we need to change to address kind of historic barriers that are created by just the way the systems have set up. If you look at the makeup of the St. Paul public school system, which is now 74%, I think was the figure, of people of color, that is a inverse from what it was just a little over a decade ago. And so systems were created, so practices were put in place, lessons were taught a certain way, and we need to kind of understand how those things need to change to adapt to a very different student population than we had a few years ago. So we work very closely with the other governmental agencies, but done a deep dive in our own work in the city of St. Paul that included police officers and members of other departments coming together to really have, as my deputy mayor Paul Williams says, knee-to-knee conversations about how we're interacting with an increasingly diverse student body population in the city of St. Paul and an increasingly diverse group of folks. So I won't go into a lot of detail unless there's questions for that. again, just on some of the other things that we're doing on early learning. I want your leadership and the leadership of this committee and this and the state legislature on early learning has been remarkable. We know how important this is. It's gratifying to know that the state of Minnesota is making such great strides. The state scholarships for high-quality early learning opportunities are just wonderful. The all-day kindergarten, I think, is an incredibly important first step. I think some of the challenges that we're finding are just having facilities in our some of our most needy neighborhoods for opportunities for children to have those early learning experiences. I think that's something that we're going to have to look at a little bit as we go forward. It was one of the things that we worked on very early on was the development of that scholarship program, and we were very happy to pilot that in the city of St. Paul. There are just, unfortunately, too many low-income families right now that are not having access to those programs, and that's an incredible challenge and a barrier. If I read everything that I have before me, we would be here all day long. I know there are other speakers to testify. I just want to check with my staff to just say if there was one thing that we could highlight. I would just really stress it's the partnership. It is this understanding that we're all in this together, that it is the business community, it is the philanthropic community, it is governmental leaders, it is the school district, it's teachers, it's everybody has to be pulling in the same direction, and we've got to move forward on this. The good news is we are making progress. The better news is I have rarely been in a room in the last year, whether it's CEOs or community members, where the conversation hasn't somehow turned, and if it wasn't turning, I turned it that way, to the issue of closing the achievement gap. This is, I think, the essential issue of our time. I think it is how future generations will measure our work here, whether it's in the Capitol or in City Hall. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mayor, for the partnership, the progress. You have a lot of very good suggestions on what's working that will help us as we get together formally in 2 weeks for a short session. But there will be opportunity to address where we're at. Does anyone will entertain maybe one question? Senator Bonoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, thank you so much for being here and for the work you're doing in St. Paul. As part of the Early Learning Council, I did have a chance to visit one of your early learning centers and the schools and was so impressed with how you have approached that whole area. So I do appreciate that. I can't help, though, with you sitting here, but ask about what's going on currently with the negotiations and whether or not you see a role for yourself in perhaps bridging that, because obviously there isn't anybody who wants our kids not to be able to go to school.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, I am very concerned about this current state of the negotiations and where those are heading. I'll spare the superintendent having to even she just went through a 7.5-hour board meeting last night, so I'll spare her having to weigh in on this. I think there, you know, the challenge is I think that what the St. Paul Federation Teachers is asking for is something that we all support. We all support smaller class sizes. We all support more social workers and more librarians and folks in the school system that can help children. But at some point, there are some challenges, not the least of which is budgetary ones. If you took the total package that the Teachers Federation is asking for, it's $150 million additional funding that would be required over the next 2 years and a $250 million budget. So, and a $30 million current referendum dollars in the city of St. Paul. So I think while we all can agree with the goals, there are some practical, tactical impediments to getting there. And the challenge that I have right now in the current conversations that are being had is we're making great progress. If the children were to lose, they've already lost so much time because of being weather-related closures. To lose even a couple more weeks during the course of a strike, and that would be an optimistic, prediction. But to lose a couple months, it would just set us back so much so far. So I hope that we can continue the conversation and continue to agree that we all have this very shared and similar goals. But let's not have that fight in a way that hurts our children.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Concluding remarks, Superintendent.
Well, as the mayor said, please be sure if you need additional information to let us know. We have, if you have some spare time, which you not always have, come and visit. I think the best story is not what I can tell you, it's what you can see. And you can ask the kids and see how engaged and how wonderful our staff is to just take this new challenge and ensure that all kids have a quality education. Very proud to be the superintendent.
We thank each of you for your partnership and your passionate leadership.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, from Minneapolis Public Schools, the CEO, Michael Gore. And welcome.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Gore. I'm the CEO of Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm into my seventh month as a CEO of the school district, but I'm not so new to the school system. I was working for the district 12 years ago. Then subsequently I've left and toured the state, toured the nation as with a wonderful superintendent that I met in Minneapolis named Carol Johnson. So her and I had an opportunity to lead in Memphis, and most recently I was the deputy superintendent of Boston Public Schools. And I came back not as the CEO, but I came back to lead Generation Next. I know you will have a speaker next. Mayor R.T. Ryback is now taking the lead. So he is now taking the helm of Generation Next, and I've decided to join the team of Minneapolis Public Schools as a CEO. So I'm a proud, also graduate of the school system of Minneapolis, a proud graduate of Washburn High School. So I'm immensely grateful for my opportunity as a CEO of the school district and lead the district in terms of work that you have heard from Commissioner as well as the mayor and Superintendent Silva. Rather than getting into a lot of overhead presentation, I just want to highlight a few areas. And I know, as you noted, Mr. Chair, there are a number of different speakers who are speaking on this subject. And as well established, I think, by the commissioner, some of the data points, and as well as a recognition by the school district, there is a lot of work to be done, especially Minneapolis Public Schools, in our effort to really eliminate or reduce our the gap that exists among our subgroups, either by race or income level. And also, you have heard from Superintendent Silva as well as Mayor Coleman some of the things that they're leading, which kind of highlights in common denominator in terms of work that we're doing in Minneapolis as well. So in terms of rigor that you hear, in terms of AVID and others, obviously Minneapolis School also have adopted, as well as other school districts, be it St. Paul. But I just want to highlight a couple of areas in terms of slight difference, perhaps. And within your packet, you will see materials, and our population between Minneapolis and St. Paul is slightly different in a couple of a very unique way. And as you heard, in St. Paul, they have about 70% students of color, and so do we. But our population is slightly different in a number of different ways. One is our African-American group is a little bit larger, as well as our highly students who are highly mobile populations larger than St. Paul. But in general, in terms of comparison, I think is a fair comparison as well. So to that end, work that we're undertaking in Minneapolis, I think, requires some discussion about our work of organizational discipline. Anytime when we talk about reform in terms of education achievement gap, we hear, obviously, Commissioner shared with us a lot of the data. But sometimes, I think, in K-12 world, which I've experienced, we tend to chase many little shiny objects and the best practice here or best practice there or latest trend here, latest trend there. And we don't give it enough time for a particular program to establish and create base. So one of the things that we have rolled out in Minneapolis Public School has been is in part of our academic strategy is what we call focus instruction. What focus instruction is really adopting a high rigorous standard, common core standard in the state as well as in the nation and focus, making sure, regardless of who you are, your income level and your race, we expect a very specific outcome in terms of our instruction. So for us, we are well on the way of year number two of focused instruction. And recognizing also when we instituted focused instruction, we have eliminated many different curriculums throughout the system. So prior to instituting focused instruction, we had a number of different schools having their separate curriculum that is very different. With respect to Minneapolis, with our students being highly mobile, you need to have a common curriculum. So when kids attend one school over another school, that they are really receiving common curriculum. So to a degree, we are instituting what we call a focused instruction that is rigorous. The expectation, regardless of your income level or your race, that we have a very specific outcome that we're measuring. That really means also recognizing as we institute rigor, the reality is that we will have an issue of a gap, academic gap, that we need to recognize and provide additional support for some of our subgroup students as well. So, and I think that our view in the Minneapolis school is we don't want to reduce the rigor sake of getting some outcome. We want to maintain rigor and recognizing that there will be a gap between a race and gender as well as income level, and we will work through and have a very specific programs to really identify and provide support for some of our key students. So to that end, just a couple of areas that I could highlight. One of the things that we're doing this year that is slightly different in context of, as I say, focus instruction or adopting Common Core is having what we call mid-year adjustment. One of the things the commissioner also talked about is data, and we are trying to use data as a foundation for a lot of changes in instructional adjustments. And one of the things that we're doing is looking at data, what are the things we can do somewhat differently in instruction? So based on last November discussion we had with the board, we are instituting a very different strategies for upcoming year, starting in January, just past month, where we're pushing in what we call co-teaching model, where that there are schools that exist needed additional support, where that we need to lower some of our class sizes in terms of students and based on income level as well as academic performance. We are begin to identify key strategies where we can push in additional instructional teachers in a classroom. So rather than having one teacher teaching 31 or 32 students, we're looking to identify two teachers who can potentially split the classrooms as well as having a pullout section for our students who might need additional support. Because that is based on a very sound, grounded research on how we educate our students who are English language learners. So we have a significant population of English language learners, and one of the things that we're doing also is learning from what's working, what's not working in Minneapolis public schools, and also for that matter, St. Paul public schools, where they do a very good job with our English language learners. And the instruction that we use for English language learners, where that we have a co-teaching model between our regular teacher and our ESL teachers, we're finding that same strategies are working for our poor students as well, poor students who are students of color, specifically our African-American students. So we are seeing that the same sort of strategies we're helping our English language learners are also helping our African-American students. So based on those kind of the data points and continuous improvement process that we're using in Minneapolis, that we are, in fact, begin to change our instructional strategy where, in fact, we are providing additional teachers in the classroom. So as of January of this year, that we have identified 13 schools, and we have identified a number of teachers within our own central office. So one of the things that we're doing is reallocating our existing resources where we have a lot of our staff that are teaching in central office. We're reallocating those folks into classrooms, into schools, and along with providing co-teaching model, we're also providing what we call instructional coaches, things that we have learned from some of the work that Commissioner Caselli has talked about in terms of a regional centers of excellence, and I think that we are beginning to understand and gathering information and sustaining that work as well. So I just want to highlight that little bit at some of the changes that we're doing. Along with that, you have heard from St. Paul as well in terms of we have begun to define, not so subtly defining time very differently. And when we talk about time, typically we talk about time in a given day. Typical instructional day consists of 6 or 6.5 hours a day. And what we're doing in Minneapolis, we want to define time very differently in a number of different ways. One is we are beginning to institute Saturday schools. Saturday schools especially for our ELL students. We need to have additional time with our students. And during the day, we have a instructional time of 6.5 hours a day, and we feel that we need additional time on Saturday. So we have begun to open our Saturdays, what we call Saturday schools for our ELL students. And also our high schools have opened up Saturdays for our students who are working on IB as well AP classes, and begin to teach our students, giving them additional tutorial services for our students who are getting ready for tests in terms of IB as well as AP. So we have opened Saturday as an opportunity for additional instruction. Along with that, we are now looking at Spring Break Institute. So as you know, Spring Break is coming just around the corner in March. And I know a lot of our community members and our teachers and parents and students have a opportunity to take time off during spring break. But not all students have that access, especially Minneapolis Public Schools. And some of our students, in light of most recent school closure that we had due to the weather, need some additional instructional time. So we have identified, over 13 schools throughout our community where they will open up during spring break. And we have identified teachers, we have identified students, we'll deliver instruction during Spring Break Institute, what we call Spring Break Institute, where we're being strategic in identifying schools and students to really provide them with additional instruction where they need additional time with our great teachers. To that end, another work that we are underway is teacher evaluation. I think Commissioner mentioned earlier about teacher evaluation in terms of how that is a part of our part of the strategy, and likewise, Minneapolis Public Schools use that as a means to really make change in specifically recognizing our teachers who are doing wonderful work. So, just this year, we have completed over 2,400 teacher observation. We are kind of leading the work right now, as well as over 2,000 student feedback survey has been incorporated, and 1,200 teachers receive value-added data results. And those three parts of the data points has gone back to schools, individual teachers, for them to look at and for them to reflect and adjust their instructional strategy, as well as for us to identify teachers who are needing additional support based on teacher evaluation, that we have begun to provide additional support for our teachers, as well as opportunity for us to recognize teachers who are doing wonderful work in Minneapolis Public Schools. And for those teachers, creating opportunity for those teachers to teach in high-need areas. So if you look at our geography, and we have a concentration of schools that has high poverty and a high turnover. And what we are trying to do is create a condition through our teacher negotiation where the opportunity for those teachers who are considered to be great teachers in our system to teach in our high-need area. So we are in the middle of our contract negotiation, and we are hopeful that we come up with a very good contract in the future. So we have a timeline that we hope to complete our negotiation by end of February, early March. And to that end, I think that I can say enough regarding our collaboration with our teachers union and working together to make sure that our kids are receiving instruction and rigorous instruction, high quality instruction every day, which includes, as I said earlier, Saturday schools that we're opening up, as well as the Spring Break Institute that we're creating for Spring Break Academy for our students. So in collaboration with our teachers union, we're able to roll that out and providing our students with additional support. Just a couple of additional comments I think was mentioned earlier about, partnership. I just want to make two things, partnership and early literacy part, the work that we're engaged in. As Mayor Coleman mentioned, I think we can learn a lot from the city of St. Paul and Mayor's leadership and what he has created in Sprockets and this partnership paradigm that he spoke of. We in public education have students about 6 hours a day or 6.5 hours a day. That means the majority of the time our students are not with us. That requires for us to have a really strong partnership in many different ways. Partners with our community partners who are providing services, partners with our churches, partnership with our business community, partners with our different stakeholders. Because education and achievement gap is not just on one aspect of rigor. In order for us to really provide high-quality education, we need to also recognize we need to create a wraparound services. Recognizing our students need holistic intervention. If students are need mental services, they can very well sit in a classroom and receive instruction. If students are going poor, if a student is hungry, they can very well pay attention to what's going on in classrooms. If they're homeless and they have no place to live, they can't really come to school every day and receive great instruction. So those are some broader challenges, and that requires for all of us who are part of our community to be really and be part of our greater partnership where we create a wraparound services and holistically educating our kids. And obviously, Minneapolis Public Schools, we first recognize we need to do a better job of delivering instruction. But also we call upon our partners, as Mayor Coleman has done in St. Paul, and we are looking forward to really learning from St. Paul and replicating those sort of partnership model, and also working very closely with my former organization, Generation Next, and on the Mayor Ryback, and in terms of how we can create great partnership. Just a point of fact, in Minneapolis alone, we have over 260 different partners. And I truly don't know what all they do for us. I don't know which of our partners are really working, which partnership are really not helping us at all. So one of the things that we're hopefully work very closely with Generation Next is really truly identifying which partnership are really rigorous helping our students, providing a necessary support that we're really talking about. So I think partnership is a critical. I can't say enough about the work that Mayor Coleman has done in St. Paul, and we hope to learn a lot more and replicate a successful model. And to that end, early childhood is also a pivotal strategy. Our pre-K-3, and I think you have heard from Superintendent Silva, and you will hear a lot more from other speakers who are far more knowledgeable about this area. In Minneapolis Public School, we have our own pre-K program called High Five, and we have about 1,000 students, a little bit over 1,000 students being served by us, half-day program. And we have over 600 students who are on a waiting list. So every year that we ratchet up our capacity to serve more kids in our school system, and obviously demand is there in terms of a high-quality pre-K program. And I think if we invest correctly, and we are in Minneapolis Public School doubling down on pre-K-3, ensuring that if we are to do a proper work in pre-K-3, that we will eliminate achievement gap and eliminate a problem we're faced in terms of high school graduation. So I can't say enough in terms of value of pre-K program and what we're seeing in terms of those students who go through our pre-K High Five program are ready in rate of 80%. And so when we do assessment, their readiness assessment is right around 80 percentile. So we are continuously investing our work, making sure that we have available space for our students and moving forward our broader work of reducing achievement gap. Mr. Chair, I know I can have additional comments. I know there are other speakers are after me. I can say just in a summary, I think that one of the things that we're consistently doing is having a very clear academic vision, recognizing that there's a sense of urgency for us to eliminate the reduced achievement gap and disparity that exists in our community. We're well aware of the challenges, and we think that we have a set of vision that will get us there. We want to make sure that we stay the course and be disciplined as an organization, being disciplined as a central office, and also providing our schools and our principals and teachers proper support and proper structure And we think that in a matter of short time that we'll begin to see positive trend lines, and we're already seeing some positive results. As Superintendent, as Commissioner Casella stated earlier, she's going to be releasing graduation rate, and we're looking forward to seeing what the result shows. And we're hopeful and we're optimistic, and that we need obviously all support from all community members in order for us to really accelerate in our work in terms of student achievement. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gore. And we will need to get to our next testifiers, but the recommendations that you've made will be addressed at a future meeting, and we'll continue that.
So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, R.T. Rybeck and Frank Forsberg, Generation Next. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and I very much appreciate being here. The first words out of my mouth, I want to be thank you. Which is, first off, thank you for bringing this the light onto this issue that we need to continue to do. That light should feel something that illuminates but also puts a lot of heat on everyone, including all of us, to make sure that we cannot tolerate something that is really one of the most shocking single statistics that you could ever have about an incredible state like Minnesota. You cannot be a brain power state if a large part of the population is not achieving at the level that they need to be. Thank you also because this body and the governor moved forward with some exceptionally important steps in making sure that before kids go to school, that they have the right outcomes they have. Frank Forsberg, who's with me, who shares his time between the United Way and Generation Next, will dive into that a little bit. But I wanted to just touch very briefly on what Generation Next is and what its role is. And before I do that, I want to underscore how important it has been to have Michael Gore move to the district and partner with the superintendent, who are both, as individuals and professionals, deeply and passionately committed to addressing this gap. Michael had my job before doing that. I worked very closely with him in that role, and the discipline and focus that he's brought, I think, has been critically important. Yesterday, we met with Mayor Coleman, Superintendent Silva, and the whole network that you heard much more about earlier. And it's really, as difficult as this challenge is, it's incredibly encouraging to see that there's been a tipping point in this community in which there is clearly an understanding that about this challenge, clearly an urgency there. A final point that I think is critical before I give a very quick overview about what we do is there's also an increased appreciation for the opportunity we have. We face global competitiveness issues. People from around the globe are now not only our partners but our competitors. With that challenge, we have a phenomenal asset, and that is populations in Minneapolis and St. Paul that cross cultural barriers every day. They have an incredibly rich understanding of language and culture, and if we get this thing right, we're going to be able to be global powerhouses. So this work is urgent because of the disparity. It's urgent because of the opportunity. Generation Next. It's a coalition of the largest foundations and businesses in the community that have put their money in the center of their table to say we're going to hold up what works, hold up what doesn't, and do everything possible to align the public and private resources toward getting good outcomes. Sitting at our table are our board, chaired by Kim Nelson of General Mills and President Kaler of the university. And our board represents the largest foundations, McKnight, Minneapolis, Minnesota Philanthropy Partners, Cargill, Target, 3M, and a large coalition that represents many people. Our board also includes the unions from both districts, who we think are important partners as well. Over the past couple of years, networks have been convened across the different goals that we have. We have five key goals. Number one, every kid is ready for kindergarten. Number two, that every child masters reading by third grade. Number three, that every child masters math, especially algebra, by eighth grade. Number four is that every child graduates from high school. And number five is every child completes some post-secondary accreditation, a college degree, a community college degree. It could, in fact, be a vocational or trade experience. But those are our goals, and they're very, very clear. What we're doing in each of those is different because the solutions are different. Frank will, as I say, get in a bit into what we're doing getting ready for K. Right now, our largest and most significant focus will be on the issue of what are the key metrics we have to get to make sure every kid masters reading by third grade. We know that reading is important. After third grade, reading becomes critical because it becomes the key to learning every other function. And right now, about 40% of the kids of color in Minneapolis are proficient in reading by third grade, about 36% in St. Paul. That is an abysmal number. We're incredibly encouraged by the focus that the superintendent and Michael Gore have brought to that. When we met with them 2 weeks ago on this topic, as we were going over the data that we had, Michael was able to pull out a map of specifically which schools have outcomes that are doing well and which aren't. We then mapped the data, and the data is critically important, and you'll hear us going back to this very often, because when you really talk about this issue in the community, everybody says everybody knows what works, but everybody doesn't agree on what that is. And that's a very important point. So what we're doing is trying to set the ideology apart and dive into the data. So we've done scattergrams showing the schools, some in the district, some that are charters. We're supporting all of them, but really looking at which schools are high achievement and with a high history of achievement and high growth, which ones have a history of low achievement and high growth, and holding those up especially that have had a history of low growth and high achievement, and really doing the forensic analysis of what's working within all of that. You then see that what we're doing is trying to get under the data that we see, like the report that came out today, and pick apart pieces that may give us a clue about what's working. For instance, if you look at the difference between school readiness for the Somali population, it's about 78%. It's about 30% lower for Latino and Hmong students. There's something in that that we need to learn. We're doing a forensic analysis of this that goes way beyond just the data that we're seeing in the papers, and that's important. This is important because we're calling this almost like a crime show on television, CSI MSP. We've got to pick apart this data and do what they do in the crime show. The crime occurs, and we have a crime here to have this kind of a gap. But then throughout that hour, you get a series of pieces of information, and you lay that on top about it. We know this problem is about race, but we also know it's about more. So our ability now to have gotten data from Hennepin County on mobility allows us to say it's about race, but it's also about the fact that kid may or may not be in that classroom every day, and they may be moving. What are the effective strategies that address that? So we're layering different pieces of information on top of it. We're digging into the learning strategies in these different schools that are showing growth in low achievement areas, and we'll be focusing especially on the strategies to get those up to scale. I mentioned that we're focused especially on third grade reading. We'll be following that with math and a coordinated STEM agenda that is already coming out of partners like Boston Scientific, 3M, and Wilder. Some really good work is moving on that. We're going to continue to work on the high school graduation with the superintendent and with Michael Gore and the team in St. Paul, and we'll be focused on the graduation rates. We'll be moving, I believe, as quickly as humanly possible on this, but we're also going to hold up the fact that there are strategies that are different when you address some kids of color. There is also an asset we need to do, and we're going to be holding up the need for every child in Minnesota to know two languages and master those in a global economy. If you take that metric, which we're now gathering, you really see that the populations that we're talking about have very different outcomes. Our immigrant communities come to this country speaking other languages, and it is critical for them to learn English and master reading by third grade, but it is also critical for those young people to retain their second language and for the rest of us to do that as well. So we'll be holding that up as we go forward. I just want to say finally the key point is the part of this work that I was most engaged in my time as mayor was that I spoke to every ninth grader in Minneapolis schools for about 8 years, and we put about 18,000 young people through summer jobs, and about 95% of those were kids of color, and about 80% of those were kids in poverty, and about 30% of those were from immigrant families. We had a very high expectation for those young people. There was not an excuse. They were required to succeed, and raising that bar very high is important. Putting the onus on this community to solve this problem is critical for our children, but having our children understand that we have exceptionally high expectations for them is also part of our work. With that, I wanted to turn it over to Frank to talk about the work he's doing both with Generation Next and United Way on the part of this work that's about making sure every kid comes to school ready to learn.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee. It's a pleasure to be back with you. In previous conversations with you, I've You may know that I've been leading an effort across the state for early learning scholarships known as Mini Minds. And on behalf of Mini Minds and the work with Generation Next, I want to thank you for your great support and leadership in the last session. Taking that first step with the early learning scholarships is really a promising way to move forward, and also all-day kindergarten, just to name two really things to be thankful for. So thank you. United Way's mission is to unite caring people to build pathways out of poverty. And we see the best long-term pathway out of poverty is to address and to close the educational achievement gap. That's what brings me here today. That's what my board has asked that I spend my time working on at a high leadership level, both across the state and in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. Just two quick comments about early childhood education and getting all kids fully ready for kindergarten. When we began this work some years ago, the data was pretty consistent. About half of our children across the state would enter kindergarten fully ready. That means half the kids were not ready. And there are many ways we could be concerned about that, a moral and ethical way. You could have a long-term business case about our workforce. You could also have an economic case that every class of incoming kindergartners who are not fully prepared will ultimately cost our state $800 million through the lifetime of those kids in additional costs. But when we look at the progress here around access and the gaps, as we work with Generation Next in the Twin Cities, we've begun to collect the waiting lists for the great kindergarten readiness programs run by the two school districts, by the Head Start programs, by the child care programs at the both counties. We're able to get to at least 5,000 children who are on the current waiting list. And it's probably more once we get done mapping and really identifying from a data perspective what are the real needs. But I want you to know those needs are out there, and we're documenting them, I think, in a really robust way. Good news. Due to your efforts, at least 1,000 early learning scholarships are coming online right now, increasing the capacity at both school districts, at both Head Starts, and across the child care programs in our community. That will make a great contribution toward closing this gap, and I just wanted you to know how real-time your efforts are and how it's felt in Generation Next. Also want to acknowledge our great partner in the Department of Education. I know the commissioner spoke earlier and is hopefully still here right behind me, so thank you for their great leadership in getting these scholarships out. My last point is around quality. Access is really important, but it has to be directed to high-quality programs. We're a great advocate of advancing the parent-aware quality rating system and making sure that the entire system is of the highest quality possible. That matters for kids. And I want you to know that those of us in philanthropy, United Way, and many others are committed partners with the state, so you're not going alone. So in this case, United Way, as just one example, is right in the middle of making a $3 million investment in increasing the quality standards of at least 350 child care centers in the Twin Cities, all who serve low-income children. Collectively, those 350 centers serve more than 20,000 low-income children just in the Twin Cities. My other philanthropic partners are doing great things across the state, so I want you to know, as we work in a coordinated fashion, it's a very strong public private partnership. We're focused on data-driven results around access and quality. And again, my thanks for your support.
Just if I could, and before we open, a couple other quick points we wanted to mention that are incredibly important. In the areas of highest disparity in both cities, we have tremendous partners that are very engaged in the work of bringing parents much more directly into all of this. The Northside Achievement Zone in Minneapolis, the St. Paul Promise neighborhood are really exceptionally strong partners in bringing parents to the table. They are clearly one of the key challenges and opportunities we have here. In both places, parents are going through partnerships like the Northside Achievement Zone's Family Academy, where parents learn the specifics about what is important for our children. And that has been a tremendous partnership. The second point I wanted to underscore was the importance of the SLEDS data, the statewide longitudinal survey that really began with the Recovery Act and is really now about helping us get this map of exactly where kids are on their learning continuum and helping us track to make sure kids aren't falling through the cracks. This is groundbreaking work. It's going to take a while. A while is not helpful in a place where we are incredibly impatient. The folks leading that, I wanted to say Senator Pogemiller, but Larry Pogemiller in his new role. Commissioner, it's really tough to get rid of these political handles, but you learn.
You understand, Mayor.
Yeah. But the commissioner and his team are doing an exceptional job. One place that you could push very hard would be to make sure that every partner in the state who can possibly be part of that SLEDS data, put that data in with as few boundaries as possible. Data is absolutely critical to us. And if we were able, for instance, to overlay mobility much more intuitively and simply over student outcomes, we could know much more about what it takes to get a kid's outcome better. There are so many pieces of data in there within the health and human services area, within even the transportation areas, that we need to put as much as we humanly can into that pot and support what the Commissioner Pogemiller and his team is doing, support the SLEDS work, and bring an urgency to that to make sure that people break down every barrier possible.
Well, I serve on the P20 Council, which has a relationship with the SLEDS data and, you know, for the student longitudinal educational data, and people might get real sleepy if we get into it, but it's powerful.
Yep.
What is going to be collected and measured, and, you know, the whole national data campaign, you know, the director, I believe, is right out of Chaska, and I've asked, you know, is all this data, the silos, is it, what does it mean to the investigators, now that you're a CSI investigator?
Right.
But you get it, that you need to analyze it. And I just looked at a chart that, and I'll share, I think it was given at the recent chamber meeting, where they and others have said, you know, let's examine the data, you know, going back to early intervention. And and if you've put out the call to be involved, and there's got to be a way to do that if we have to legislatively amend that. We had the appropriation last session for, I think it was 800 and some thousand for additional data collection. And, yes, Commissioner Pogemiller's overseen that, but it's with the P20 Council. So that's something we need to follow up on further, and there may have to be some statutory change.
Senator, I applaud you for going forward with willing brain damage. It is really tough to be in a room with a bunch of people for a few hours going over data. That work matters so much to addressing this issue, because it is about race and much, much more, and we have to get into the nuance of that. We know a lot about the kids who are falling through the cracks, and we really owe it to them to be able to, say, set aside every possible boundary we can. There's a lot of law in the middle of all of this, I think we all know. But honestly, one of the most important, if not the most important thing you could do in this session, would be to take all the pieces of information the state already knows, allow that to be connected more robustly and faster in SLED, so that those of us on the ground can implement strategies quicker.
Sarah Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wonderful to see you both here today. Thank you. On that subject, one of the tough things that we grapple with is the Social Security number, because we don't collect the E-12 data using a Social Security number. We use the MARS number. But the problem with that is the MARS number doesn't translate into workforce numbers. So you can't really finish the search and the understanding without shifting to a Social Security number. And so that raising that question brings up all the concerns around privacy. But I would just state that I think those concerns can be solved and are important to solve, and that we would be served to move towards a unifying number. And so I would ask that we spend some time this session to consider that.
Mr. Chair and Senator, this is one of those points of brain damage that matters a lot. As I understand that issue, one branch of state government doesn't need to collect a Social Security number for employment data, and so they don't. But that means that you can't take those two databases together. And what does that mean for a kid? That means that that kid's outcome in school is not being tracked through that, and we can't intervene as quickly as we need to. You know, when you get a kid who's not graduating from high school, there'll always be someone who will stand by and say, I knew that would happen. Well, shame on you for not acting on that first early warning sign. So the goal here, again, like a crime show, let's bring the tape back. Let's go back to where you begin to see something would happen, and let's intervene early. That can only be done if the work that you, that really detailed work in SLEDS, is done so that the rest of us can implement strategies.
I'm sure you've analyzed the end game when you get to whodunit.
We're getting there. It's a whole hour show.
Okay.
With commercials.
R.T. Ryback, Frank Forsberg, thank you for your efforts, and we'll look forward to some legislation this upcoming session. Great.
Could I make one final point? I'm sorry to do this, but you're going to be hearing later from Dane Smith of Growth and Justice, who's part of a coalition doing similar work in other parts of the state. We're very supportive of that work, and we'll do anything possible to help them to use our methodology, share what they're doing, vice versa. This is a statewide issue. It's more magnified in the two largest cities, but we're very much supportive of their work.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Leanne Stevens, Minnesota Teacher of the Year 2006, and we've had the pleasure of hearing her before, and we welcome you back. And I also want to mention the next speaker following Ms. Stevens is Nick Faber, and I'm going to ask Nick if he could join the table with you as well, both being teachers, but we'll just in the interest of time as well. So please proceed, and Ms. Stevens.
Okay. Good morning, and thank you for having me here again. But I was wondering, am I the only one who got the memo for 5 minutes? Because I was like, wait a minute. I saw 5 minutes. Not 5 minutes. Anyway.
You're right.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so I come to you as a teacher with a plethora of experience with elementary school, junior high, and senior high as well. I spent 12 years in Minneapolis. Mr. Gore, where is he? But that's a whole nother story. I won't tell you how I ended up in St. Louis Park. But anyway, that's so I'm in St. Louis Park now. So we know the topic at hand is critical, and I have gone to so many sessions and committee meetings, and I was at something yesterday at the U talking about this achievement gap. And right now, I want to come to you as boots on the ground, I guess, so to speak, and as a teacher, and what there are some principles that I adhere to that I feel has made an impact on this racial disparity and narrowing it with my experience with my students. And I have taught hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, hundreds of students. So my first thing is to do whatever it takes to ensure the success of all students. And I have a story, because I can relate to students and stories, and I will change her name because I don't have her permission to use her name, but her name is Diara. And Diara had really difficult, I would say, home life. Her mother had some intellectual challenges, and so she couldn't help her at all with homework. But I would give all my students, from the very time I started teaching, they would have my personal home number, and then as cell phones came around, then my cell phone number. And so they all get my cell phone number because I feel like I'm the best resource for them if they need help. And so when they needed help for homework, I'd say, you know, call me so I can go over it with you. Well, DR would call me every single night, and she called me every night because her mother couldn't help her. But I felt like it was my responsibility to be available for her because this is something that I was saying that I needed you to do, but I needed to help her be successful. And like clockwork every night, and I didn't get irritated because I knew that her mom could not help her. So for me, that was doing whatever it takes to help her become successful. Another thing for me is to eliminate the blame game. So blaming external factors such as their home life, their parental situation, their socioeconomic status, to me tends to lower expectations. And then low student expectations, in my opinion, often condone justification for poor performance. So if I rely on blaming external factors and I absolve myself from my responsibility as a teacher, these are my principles. So I'm not saying these are everybody's principles, but these are my principles. I believe that struggling students deserve the highest quality of teaching. Like, they are often the most challenging and are known to frustrate the teacher. And so, therefore, a lot of times they're sent with a parent volunteer or a paraprofessional. And we have excellent paraprofessionals. I'm not saying that. But as a classroom teacher, they're ultimately my responsibility. And so if a student struggles, they need me. They need me. And even I know when we would do some pullout for like Title I for math, have students pull. I would take the helm and say, no, I'm going to do a push-in. You're going to work in the classroom with me because I need to see what's going on, and I'm ultimately responsible for all of my students. And that worked really, really well. And sometimes as teachers, you just have to say, you know what, this is what's best for the student, and this is what we're going to do. Another principle for me, if my students fail, then I failed. And I mean, it's inevitable that you'll have a few students who will struggle with a certain concept, but if half my students fail, then I failed to teach them. And so if they didn't learn it, then I probably did a presentation, but presenting isn't teaching. And I think it's important that we take responsibility and ownership for that. And then we don't come back and teach it the same way or talk a little louder. We need to use another strategy. And if we don't know, it's okay, because sometimes we don't know everything, and that's fine. But then you might have a colleague who does know, and you can consult that colleague. And then my last one is to respect and love students like they're my own. And we all know how important relationships are. Relationships are key to all students. But I can't teach effectively if I don't know my students. And I'm not, you know, putting anybody down, but I don't get to know my students by handing out a survey at the beginning of the school year. That's just not my thing. But for me, I will have lunch with you. I will have breakfast with you. I will be outside at recess with you. I will go to your events. That's how I will talk with you, have conversation. That's how I get to know my students. And I remember I was sharing this at a conference, and someone was like, oh, well, you can say that, you know, and because you don't have a certain number of students. And I said, you know what? I've had 125 students. I have 5 classes, and I could tell you something about every single one of those students, because that was a priority for me. And I want to leave you with, there's another thing, too, I was going to say. Sorry. My 5 minutes, are they up? No, I don't know. But they're not, like, I notice things, too, details. Like, I'll notice a new haircut or a new pair of shoes. So those things are really important, particularly to students of color. Like, oh, wow, she noticed me. And I pronounce names correctly. I don't try to Europeanize the names. I pronounce them correctly, and I think that's key as well. But I wanted to leave you with 2 quotes by the great educator Marva Collins. One of them was, she said, I hear teachers and educators complaining about how far a child is behind, what a child doesn't know. But that's what we're there for. It's not a problem. You can see it as a problem, or you can see it as a challenge. And the last thing that she said, was not the last thing she said, but another quote, she said, don't try to fix the students, fix ourselves first. So I thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Ms. Stevens, for your leadership. We have a new teacher evaluation law that's being piloted in several districts. It'll go in effect in the upcoming school year, 14. And is this going to improve the delivery of instruction, do you feel? Obviously, a high-quality teacher is a very important part of the strategy for closing the achievement gap.
Absolutely. It depends on the fidelity of it. I think evaluation is important. I believe that teachers want that. I know I want it, but they want meaningful feedback, and they don't. So if there's an area that where I struggle as a teacher, well, then don't just tell me that I'm struggling. Then give me the support to get better. And so what resources are coming my way? Coach me to get better in that area. And sometimes I might need you to be in my classroom every day for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever. But if you just come in and you check it off and, you know, you didn't do well here, and then I'm supposed to find a way to figure this out, not everybody's going to be able to do that. And so if there's meat to it, absolutely, absolutely, because we want to get better. I totally believe that teachers want to get better. And I believe that a poor teacher, if they really want to, they can become good, and a good teacher can go to great, and a great teacher can go to superior. And so I really believe that. So we need to look at the talent that we have in the classrooms and be able to move them forward.
Thank you very much, Ms. Stevens. Our next speaker is Nick Faber from the St. Paul Federation of Teachers, and who's been busy too.
Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to speak today. I want to speak a little bit about how our union is working to build on some of the parent engagement and equity work that the superintendent talked about as part of her presentation earlier today. So as I said, my name is Nick Faber. I'm a teacher in St. Paul and have taught there for 28 years. And besides being a teacher, I'm an officer at the St. Paul Federation of Teachers and the coordinator of our Parent Teacher Home Visit Project, which I'm here to speak to you about today. Our project trains and supports teachers in establishing partnerships with families through visits to the families' homes. It's based off a model that was developed by parents in Sacramento, California, and is spread nationally to districts in Denver, Reno, Washington, D.C., Springfield, Massachusetts, and Flint, Michigan. The parents who designed the home visit project were tired of a culture of blame in their schools and community. They understood that the two people who know students the best, the parents and the classroom teachers who are with those students all day, should be partners. And the first step in building that partnership is building a strong relationship. Our project is built on the basic belief that parents are an asset. All parents, no matter who you are, no matter what life has dealt you, you know something about your child that can make me a better teacher for your child. They are our co-educators. There are a few non-negotiables in our project that make this work. The visits are voluntary for both educators and for parents. We don't target certain students. Teachers, educational assistants, and administrators all go out in pairs for their visits. And we don't bring paperwork. We're there to establish a relationship. That first visit is about engaging the parents, so we lead with our ears. We listen. We hear from parents on how to reach their child, not tell the parents what to do. Later in the year, a teacher may conduct a second visit that is more sharing in nature. It may be sharing resources with the family about an academic concern the family had, or an invitation to the parent to develop their leadership within the school community. We started our project here in St. Paul 3 years ago when six teachers visited about 15 homes. They found the experience overwhelmingly positive for both the teachers and the students. Knowing the students and families better allowed us to adjust our instruction more precisely and communicate more effectively. But more importantly, it shined a light on our own assumptions that we had about our families, their homes, and what went on in our students' life outside of school. These visits helped break down those perceptions and also helped our families break down perceptions they had about us as teachers. That was 3 years ago. Through our work now, we have over 400 St. Paul Public School teachers, educational assistants, and administrators trained. And we conducted a total of 240 visits to families just this fall alone. And we feel we're on track to reach our goal of 400 homes visited this year. So what are the outcomes? St. Paul teachers report a higher degree of communication and comfort working with the families they visited with. And those families are much more likely to participate in activities in school after school as well. Nationally, in buildings where we have more than 60% of the teachers, classroom teachers regularly doing visits year after year, we see increases in student achievement and decreases in suspensions and absenteeism and vandalism. When paired with next step parent engagement strategies like academic parent-teacher teams, the outcomes become even more impressive. In Washington, D.C., for example, where the school district there is partnering with the Flamboyant Foundation, we found that in five schools where they piloted pairing the home visit project with academic parent-teacher teams, student attendance was up, achievement was up, suspension rates were down 83% in 1 year in those five pilot schools. One of the most telling stories comes from Stanton Elementary in Washington, D.C., where They went, again, pairing the parent home visit project with academic parent teacher teams, they went from 215 suspensions the year before to 12 the following year. Attendance rates were up at conferences from 20% at traditional conferences to 80% at the academic parent teacher teams. And attendance is in the hundreds at all their evening events. And as the administrator said to me, and we don't serve them food. The parents come because they have such a strong relationship with the teachers in that building and vice versa. And they know when they come for parent evening things that there's going to be a mutual respect and sharing of information that's valuable for both parties. That school has been used as a model by Karen Mapp at the Department of Education around what parent engagement is supposed to look like. The national network continues to grow. We are part of a national network, and the St. Paul Federation of Teachers is looked at as a regional training center for that national organization. Our regional training team has now trained outside of St. Paul. We've trained two schools in Columbia Heights and one in Eau Claire, Wisconsin this summer. And we're making plans on more trainings in districts outside the metro area as well. We'd love to come to Minneapolis. So, I have been asked to also serve as an officer on the national board, and St. Paul this summer will, next fall will host our national convention. The thing that excites me most about this work, though, is that it's about building a culture of collaboration that is centered in the community around education that reaches out to all parents. It's not expensive, it's not flashy, but we believe that relationships are the yeast in the bread we're trying to bake in this thing we call public education. Too often, efforts to close the achievement gap end up being reforms that happen to families and communities. The parent-teacher home visit project is more meaningful and enduring because it works with parents and the communities. So thank you for my 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. Questions regarding Senator Johnson?
I'm wondering if when you see in your classroom, and I don't know what age classroom you have, but when you see a student in your classroom that is failing and know that this person is likely to drop out or depending on their age, what do you do? What can you do?
Either one of you.
Well, I'm an elementary science specialist, so I see them all in the elementary grades. So one of the things I do first off is I reach out to that partner that I have. I also, like you mentioned as well, I get to know that student as well as a person, and I have the privilege as an elementary science specialist by the time they've hit sixth grade, I have a pretty strong relationship with them because I've seen them year after year after year. So they cycle through with me. So, I mean, part of it is sitting down and having frank conversation with that student and then involving their family and then thinking of strategies that we can work on together.
Absolutely. I'm at a high school. And although I work with a specific population, which would be Latino and African-American students who take advanced placement classes, honors, and IB, I still see a lot of students come to me and students who are on the verge of failing. And the first thing is to find out their story, because so often there's a backstory that we don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I find out what the backstory is and then what I can do to help them along. And so I will meet with their counselor with them. I will have conversations with their parents. I will meet with our assistant principal because we want them to graduate. We do have a program at our high school. It's a non-traditional academy, and it's for students who are kind of on the verge of not graduating. And so it's a whole different system for them. And they have a block schedule, so they'll have four classes together with the same teachers, and it's a very different environment for them. And it's been really, really successful. I think this is our second year doing it, and all the students in it have graduated. And so just finding all these other opportunities for the students, but we got to know who they are. We have to know their story.
Mr. Chair, if I might, please.
Sarah Johnson.
The reason I'm saying talking about this is because I feel that there are more non-academic reasons for children having problems in school than they are academic.
Absolutely. Can I give you an example?
If you let me give you one.
Can I give you an example?
Go ahead. Sure.
Okay. So yesterday I gave a student, she was sitting outside my office, and I was like, oh, I hadn't seen you in a little while, whatever. And she's like, are you getting ready to leave? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, I'm trying to figure out when the bus comes. And I said, oh, well, where do you need to go? And so she needed to go to her job. And I know this student. I know the issues that she has with her mother. And so and it's surprising that she's holding a job and she's doing well in school. She's on track to graduate. But yet she has this whole backstory. Her mother is an alcoholic and it's a very bad situation. And so she and I talk a lot. And I tell, you know, I encourage her and tell her you're doing all the right things. And you know, I'm not sure what's going on between you and your mom. And I don't talk bad about her mother. I'll say, you know, because I know her mom. And I'm like, I love your mother, but she has a problem right now. But this student, if you wouldn't, she doesn't really open up to people. So they might see her in a different light. And they don't know that she can't even live with her mom. And that she has to pretty much take care of herself and support herself. And she's in 11th grade trying to save money so that she can live on her own. And so these are the stories that a lot of our students have. And if we don't know that, then we're going to look at them in a whole different light. And so that to me is key. So anyway, I dropped her off at Cub.
Mr. Chair, spent yesterday visiting the Anoka-Hennepin School District, which has pretty much a lot of similar data as Minneapolis and St. Paul. And they have a food shelf in every school building in their district. They send home backpacks with food on the weekend.
Yeah,
they
we do
have
that
a
too.
Closet with toiletries, toothpaste, soap. Can you imagine what it would be like to be a 16-year-old and not to have the soap or a toothbrush and toothpaste to brush your teeth before you come to school?
So
the non-academic things, and I was so excited when I saw the paper today when the governor said free lunch for everybody, and I'm hoping that we can add free breakfast too, because in 1994 we had a three-year pilot project on the benefits of free breakfast in elementary school. It was amazing, and it included Anderson School in Minneapolis that was, at that time, was a K-8 school with many, many problems. The success was wonderful. We couldn't get it put into place. And it's so reasonable to be able to afford it. It is a very small amount of money. I would say that if we can get free lunch and breakfast for all of our kids, that probably be, if there was only one thing that we could do to help kids academically, it would be to feed them.
And feed them well.
And feed them well.
I could just take one more story also.
Very briefly.
Yes. Before I, where I started the parent-teacher home visit project in St. Paul was at John A. Johnson Elementary, which is a community school as part of the Achievement Plus program of partnering Wilder with St. Paul Public Schools. And one of the things that was so important in that community model was having those community partners right there within the building. So that if you were to walk into John A. Johnson today, one of the first things that greets you is not just our office, but also the Eastside Family Center. And that was so valuable to our teachers. Again, knowing our students and what their stories are and also knowing what their needs are. So if a kid came to us and said, I'm not going to be in school tomorrow because I'm going to be moving, we could quickly go down to the Eastside Family Center, notify them that this is happening, and they would have somebody out to that house saying, why is that happening? How can we keep you in your home so your child doesn't have to change schools? So having those resources as part of a community model is so important as well.
Mr. Faber, Ms. Stevens, again, thank you so much for your testimony and service. Members, we're so interested in this topic. I know we're near adjournment time. We're going to go to 11:15, and I apologize to the next testifiers. We're going to have to keep it at 4 or 5 minutes to hit the highlights. And so we're laying foundation for the upcoming session, and with that context, we'll proceed. And we'll ask Dane Smith and Maureen Ramirez from Growth and Justice to join us. I believe Hector Garcia is ready as well. Welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. And with the new time limit, I'll just present. We'll keep it to one presenter, and Hector could join me if you'd like to. Our policy shop is really focused on business growth. We're to help build a more prosperous and competitive Minnesota, and equally committed to economic justice, a more inclusive and equitable prosperity. And we think there's no more important priority for the long-term competitiveness of our economy and the health of our communities than closing these educational opportunity gaps. And we salute you for raising the profile of this priority. I've been an observer here for many years, and I don't recall it being the central mission of a committee hearing. You might have noticed that I said educational opportunity gaps rather than achievement gap, and these semantics are really kind of important. The terms can be used interchangeably, and I think they should be, but it is more of an opportunity gap and an investment gap than it is an achievement gap. The latter term implies a failure or even assigns blame or suggests inferiority for these children on the wrong side of the gaps. And in fact, we know that the gaps are driven by ever-widening economic and social inequality, racial inequality, which are in turn driven by globalization, epic technological change, stubborn racial bias, often hidden or unintentional. The challenge is immensely complicated, and we strongly believe, based on evidence, that our response to it must be comprehensive and collaborative. Everybody in the community involved for every child, every step of the way from cradle to career. And we heard some good news this morning that after a decade of warnings and rather scattershot responses to the gap, progress is actually being made. Recent statewide data show improvement on key measures. You heard the St. Paul District recently reporting improvement on measures for every demographic group, including whites. That's an important point to make. That's the way it has to happen. But the percentage-wise progress has to be more among kids of color who need to catch up. And before we describe more specifically our recommendations for gap closing, I do want to congratulate this legislature and previous ones for shaping policy and increasing investments in evidence-tested interventions. There's been bipartisan support for improved early education. We got breakthrough funding for high-quality pre-K learning. The world's best workforce funding bill, we love the title of that bill because it requires school districts to plan and work toward reducing gaps, and of course most districts already are engaged in that. Also, your version of the DREAM Act cleared away obstacles to higher education for thousands of students whose parents are undocumented workers. 6 years ago, after holding an education summit attended by many of you, dozens of legislators, we produced a strategic blueprint called Smart Investments in Minnesota Students. We're pleased that that philosophy has found its way in bipartisan agreement. And if there's one word that sums this strategy up, it is comprehensive. We do not believe we can make significant progress with just one or two or three policy changes, are putting all our new investment in one or two baskets. I like the term shiny objects that Michael Gore used. Refrain from pursuing the shiny objects. Focus on the comprehensive investment. We think a consensus has emerged on the specific roadmaps, the Generation Next model, specific and varied achievement and attainment goals derived from total community collaboration. Parents and students, businesses, teachers, principals, everybody in. Our strategic framework includes a chart that illustrates a stair-step compounding approach The blueprint recommends evidence-tested interventions from nurse home visiting programs in early childhood to intensive focus on skills acquisition and reading comprehension from age 3 to grade 3, more rigorous coursework and in and out of school support and mentoring and tutoring in grades 4 through 8, focused post-secondary preparation in grades 9 through 12, and much more counseling and need-based aid for the transition to higher education. And one of the most promising embodiments of this strategy in Minnesota is this Generation Next initiative, about which you've heard. We have helped encourage this effort. We've served on the College and Career Readiness Action Network of Generation Next, and we hope it continues to work harder toward authentic community engagement with ever stronger inclusion of teachers and parents and communities of color. Mayor Ryback, R.T. Ryback, referred to our effort to take this Generation Next principle, which is part of a national network called Strive Together, based in Cincinnati, and it's spreading rapidly to metro areas all over the country to create a statewide movement for this model. We're in touch with and encouraging 5 greater Minnesota communities that are already part of the Strive Together network, and they're in Austin, Grand Rapids, and Itasca County, Red Wing, Northfield, and St. Cloud. We think there's efforts going on in Rochester that we're going to partner with and help encourage with Hector Garcia, who's next. So it's important to think and plan term. There's several immediate contributions this legislature can make this year. We encourage you to move toward full funding of early education interventions and approving the legislation sponsored by Many Minds. We need to expand the Many Minds Coalition. You've heard Frank Forsberg talk about that. We need to expand post-secondary enrollment options that create a seamless transition from high school to career credentials. And money matters. Public schools and public higher education systems, tuition aid for public and private colleges need additional funds. Bonding projects have to be financed. We've had a decade of declining or lagging investments. And if you'll forgive a little wordplay, undoing these gaps fits into the theme of the un-session. So just undo it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. And I'd like to welcome Hector Garcia, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council.
Thank you very much, Chair Wigger and members of the committee. I am Hector Garcia, the Executive Director of the Latino Affairs Council, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to do this presentation for you. I'd like to build on what R.T. Ryback and Ms. Stevens talked about. Her quotes, I think, are very accurate, and former Mayor Ryback's comments on opportunity and challenge in the decades-old achievement gap is quite pertinent. I believe it is our choice which of those two we pursue, you know, whether it's the challenge or the opportunity. I believe it was during his second inaugural address, President Lincoln said, "As our world is new, so we must think anew." I think if there was ever a new world, it is today. Globalization has changed dramatically the competitiveness of this nation. The creativity of the United States has been decreasing vis-a-vis other nations. The flow of migrants from poor to rich nations are in the millions, and that has had a dramatic effect in Minnesota, where the minority non-European communities have grown very quickly. Ours grew 75% between 2000 and 2010. Meanwhile, the majority, the European-American majority, is retiring. As you know, the boomer generation started to retire. And it is projected that soon there will be zero growth in the workforce. That is definitely something to be concerned about, having the worst achievement gap and lowest graduation rate of Latinos in the nation for Minnesota. I believe is a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity to harness what we bring to the table. The United States has never before needed to learn other languages and to learn other cultural perspectives as much as it does today. I think recognizing that added value from our students and from other immigrant students should be a pivotal element in growing our workforce, but also in turning this achievement gap around, which has a lot to do with low expectations. If we do not believe that our students are going to graduate or that they're going to be doing well, they won't. It's that simple. You know, the message they get from teachers and staff and schools is often, you know, we'll help you along. We know you won't amount to much, but, you know, just keep at it. I don't believe we'll ever make the world's best workforce that way. And I'm sure you will agree with that. Knowledge workers, companies, investors are looking for places where globalization is taking place. And I believe, like Superintendent Silva, that Minnesota can be the place where globalization is taking place if only we acknowledge that we need to think in a new way. Einstein said that we cannot solve a problem with the same way of thinking that created it. So if we keep pressing harder, investing more money in the same approach that we have been using for decades, it's not going to work. I believe the original American formula for economic success, though, will work. And that original formula to me as an immigrant from Mexico is that the combination of democracy, democratic institutions, constitutional law, and the energy, youth, ambition, and diverse cultural perspective of immigrants is what has made this nation as great as it has been. And there is no reason why we cannot reestablish that same formula and believe that the new non-European immigrants can fill the requirements. We have focused on Rochester in CLAC's pilot project. CLAC, as you probably know, has very, very limited resources. So we needed to be very strategic in where we focused our energy, our money, our time. And we decided to focus on Rochester. Why Rochester? Because it's a small city, and I was very happy to see when I started going there 3 years ago that they welcomed our opinions. They listened to them very carefully, and they worked with us. Some of their leaders said to me, you know, we're Europeans, we're Germans, Norwegians, and we've done a lot in this city, but you're next. They believed in our future and what we could bring to the city. Why? I don't think they're necessarily more virtuous than people in the Twin Cities or elsewhere, but I believe that the fact that they see the undocumented, non-English-speaking worker along with the wealthy Latinos who come from Latin America for treatments at the Mayo Clinic and the researchers and physicians in that clinic, the executives and engineers at IBM has made a difference. They believe that we're what we are, which is a regular community. And so we have dedicated a lot of our time to working there. And I would like to show you some of the things that we're doing there. First,
okay, Mr. Garcia, we have one more minute, and then I'm going to have the remaining testifiers. We're going to have to invite them.
Okay, I believe you have this documentation with you. I hope you'll read it because it's very important. We're using a cradle-to-career approach and the kind of full community support that was brought up by Dane Smith, who is one of our partners. We're using strategic alliances with insightful, deep thinkers on this subject, like Dane, Art Rolnick, Tordal, the famous international economist, who have graciously assisted us in putting together this program in Rochester. And we are trying to put together an early education preschool center similar to that one at the Northside Achievement Zone. We're already working with Art Rolnick on the funding. Mayo Clinic is considering it. And then K through 12 is where the Superintendent Munoz, who's on our board, is helping out. And so will Tordal, who was knighted by the King of Norway and had a lot to do with the Minnesota Miracle. Mayo Clinic, IBM, and the community, which is most important, are helping us along. We hope that you will consider listening to a more extensive presentation of our project in Rochester. Thank you very much.
Yes, and we've heard very good things on the Rochester. I just spoke to someone yesterday about that. So we'll have an opportunity in the future to further delve into it and the various subjects and suggestions. We're actually preparing for committee hearings on that right now, so we'll
thank
let
you.
You
Before
know.
I go, I'd just like to introduce Elise Ruiz. Go ahead and
hello.
Hi, committee and Chair Weiger. My name is Elise Ruiz, and I just started at Chicano Latino Affairs Council as Legislative and Community Relations Manager, Minnesota native. Been campaigning around the country, so I'm glad to be back and working at the council.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Garcia. And Dr. Rodriguez and Mr. Lay, we will reschedule for your testimony and for others. And to everyone in the room, we appreciate your kind attention. And if there's a particular item that you want to bring to our attention, just communicate to the committee. We'll share that with everyone. I mentioned we're preparing committee schedules. We're in session 2 weeks and 1 hour. And then we'll have committee meetings soon thereafter, working with Senator Torres-Ray and coordinating with the policy committee. And we hope to have some things posted within the next several days and various items that we've discussed in the hearing will be on those agendas. So there being no further business, the committee's adjourned. Yeah. Oscar music.
Oh, right, yeah.
Good. You know,
do we have money in the committee budget to hire a pit orchestra?
We have a singer.
Oh, okay.
That's in the budget. Could we meet in a little bit?
No problem.
I mean, about schedule.
Going okay.